John Ruskin, for example, he heard voices. He thought he heard a voice telling him his cat was the devil, and so he killed it. I don't have a cat anymore. And all my voices are merely facets of myself, an ensemble of things I've heard and read and thought, playing continually in harmony and in discord. The voice of my inner drive and compulsion, for example, sounds a lot like Jack London, and he plays a cello that he can throw over his shoulder and ride like a sledge down the slopes of the Klondike Gold Rush.
Don't loaf and invite inspiration. Light out after with a club.
The voice of my dear, slow, diligent self plays percussion at a steady pace. Timpani, snare drum, and tubular bells. She sounds suspiciously like Emily Dickinson.
The brain is wider than the sky.
My doubt is Dr. Johnson, playing on a creaky baby grand.
No man but a blockhead ever wrote, except for money.
While Mark Twain is on the flute and is mostly common sense.
The difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning and a lightning bug.
The blind swirl of ideas is like music in my head, maddening music. Luckily, though, I do have a sense of calm and perspective. It sounds a bit like God, as played by Michael Caine.
What thou seest, write in a book.
And it plays the slide trombone.
What thou seest, write in a book.
Which is good advice, thank you, Michael. Write what you know and what have you, but if I were to write only what I knew and what I saw, I would be writing disproportionately about disappointment and dirty mugs and grimy window panes and biscuits. And about pointless clouds floating mercilessly by, containing no hint of thunder or of lightning.
Do you see yonder cloud that's almost in the shape of a camel?
By the mass, and 'tis like a camel indeed.
Methinks it's like a weasel.
It is backed like a weasel.
Or like a whale.
Very like a whale.
Or like a sheep. And that looks like a second sheep. A third sheep. A fourth sheep.
Yes, Prince Hamlet's very sheepish.
Ah, Hamlet, the great procrastinator. Being distracted is very tiring work and not entirely helpful. You know, asleep at my desk once, I dreamt I was eating a 300-page marshmallow, and when I woke up, my manuscript was gone.
You never have to change anything you got up in the middle of the night to write,
said Saul Bellow, who sounds surprisingly like Mark Twain. I've never had a great ear for accents.
God only exhibits his thunder and lightning at intervals.
Now that is Mark Twain.
And so they always command attention.
But those intervals can last a long, long, long time. And if it lasts too long, we call it writer's block. But it's not really a block at all. What is there to be blocked? Writers are not sewage pipes or conduits, are we? Writer's block, in my experience, consists of almost entirely the opposite, the endless flow of cups of tea and coffee and losing oneself on Google. One morning, when I was making tea / wasting time on Google, I came across this.
Notes from an accidental pianist. Orthopedic surgeon Tony Chicoria, 42, was kind enough to phone his mother just to check she was safe from the storm. However, both were about to get the shock of their lives. In Tony's case, quite literally. Lightning struck the phone box, came out of the receiver, and knocked Chicoria, 42, unconscious. When he came to, not only did he have severe memory loss, but he could play piano, too. He couldn't remember ever playing piano before.
Perhaps, if I was struck by lightning, I'd be granted magic powers. It'd be nice to be able to play the piano. That's not me, but it could be. Didn't Barry Allen, a police scientist, gain super speed when he was bathed by chemicals that had been struck by lightning, becoming superhero The Flash? And Max Dillon, he was hit as he repaired a power line and turned into Electro, Spider-Man's genetically mutated nemesis. So I suppose one should be careful what one wishes for. It's just a way of explaining genius, of course, being struck by lightning. How else do we explain it? Eric Korngold wrote a ballet when he was 11. That was it, the one just playing there, the one that I could easily have been playing, given the right weather conditions. Though, in fact, that was Korngold himself playing it, age 25. I am far too old now, alas, to be any kind of prodigy. Tatum O'Neill won an Oscar, age 10. Flaubert wrote a novel at 15. I didn't write my first book until I was in my 20s, and it was terrible and unpublished. My second book, also written in my 20s, was also terrible and unpublished. My third book, ditto, and my fourth book, likewise. But my fifth book was my first published book. So my first book was my fifth book, if that makes sense, published almost 10 years to the day after I had first seriously started writing, by which time I had 3 children of my own.
A man may write at any time if he will set himself doggedly to it,
wrote the childless Dr. Johnson.
When a man writes from his own mind, he writes very rapidly. The greatest part of a writer's time is spent in reading. In order to write, a man will turn over half a library to make one book.
Dr. Johnson's mind.
This is Boswell talking now. He's a companion voice to my Dr. Johnson. You can tell them apart by the accents.
Appears like a great mill into which subjects are thrown to be ground.
My mind, alas, is more like a Moulinex or a cheap handheld stick blender, mixing stuff up. But sometimes the power goes out and you have to wait for the lightning to strike so you can see in the dark.
Think of the fabulous inhabitants of the new created Earth, who, when the first night came upon them, supposed that day would never return.
You take a grope in the dark, a stab in the dark, a shot in the dark.
When the clouds of sorrow gather over us, we see nothing beyond them, nor can imagine how they will be dispelled. Yet a new day succeeded the night.
And then another night came.
And a new day succeeded the night.
And then another night came.
And a new day succeeded the night.
It's inevitable. It's certain. There is only one thing more certain, in fact. At any public reading, at any Q&A, in a library, in a bookshop, in my own head, as I fail to sleep at night, it comes inexorably, unavoidably. Let me show you. Any questions?
Yes.
Any questions at all?
Yes.
You have a question?
Yes.
Where do you get your ideas from?
Every time. You know, I haven't a clue. All of mine are second hand, though I've heard they're available new. Some get theirs from Harrods. Some order them online. Others get theirs pickled in barrels, packed in brine.
Is that true?
It's a metaphor.
Oh, why couldn't he just say?
Okay, I know what they're like. They're all the same, these artists.
God help them if they're like me. Because here's the terrible truth, though I know it's a contradiction. My soul sits down before the fact and boils it down to fiction. My stories are a residue. They're nothing more than that. The bone you're forced to chew on when you've eaten all the fat.
Can we offer some advice, perhaps?
Sure. Everybody thinks they're an expert.
Some hints and tips on writing. Have you tried outlining? I find it very good.
Or a character questionnaire. You really should.
It's really all quite simple. Like ABC. Just join the dots, fill in the gaps, and you'll be writing just like Ian Sansom.
I hear Ian Sansom flexes his imagination with short style exercises.
I heard that he carries a notebook everywhere he goes.
I overheard that he uses conversations that he overhears in public transport.
I heard that he reads a lot.
All the advice is wrong, you know, and can be safely ignored. Story arcs, protagonists, it all just leaves me bored. The only good advice my first agent gave me was this.
Don't staple manuscripts.
And then he dropped me like a hot potato. And after that, there is no new advice under the sun.
And you see, there is no such thing as a new idea. It's impossible. We simply take a lot of old ideas and put them in a sort of mental kaleidoscope. We give them a turn and they make new and curious combinations, but they are the same old pieces of colored glass that have been in use through all the ages.
So said Mark Twain. I was rather more concise than that when I called my mind a Moulinex. It's just churning everything up, the things I've remembered, the things I've forgotten, the things that will one day make sense. Maybe that's the image of the storm, the facts and thoughts just jumbling about like particles in a storm cloud when two strong things collide.
Dear me, my postillion has been struck by lightning.
That's a famous phrase I'd almost forgotten. I found it, I think, in an apocryphal Hungarian phrase book.
He was the best postillion I ever had.
Or was it an article by James Thurber, or a confession by Dirk Bogarde, or a poem by Patricia Beer?
Pity this one. Burnt at my lord's expense, far from home, having seen every sight, but never anyone struck by lightning.
Never to be struck by lightning. I suppose the opposite of the prodigious child is the middle-aged burnout. That's more like me.
I'd rather be ashes than dust. I'd rather be a superb meteor, every atom of me in magnificent glow, than a sleepy and permanent planet.
Calm down, Jack London.
Calm down. Would you have told William Shakespeare to calm down?
A writer who obtains his full purpose loses himself in his own luster.
We'd never know how high we are till we are called to rise. And then, if we are true to plan, our statures touch the sky.
It's better to burn out than fade away.
That's the voice of God again, quoting Neil Young. Easy to get the two confused. Both Canadian. Lots of artists hear themselves think and mistake it for the voice of God, believing they're like titans, like Prometheus, stealing the divine flame. It's an occupational hazard. The Institute for Personality Assessment and Research at the University of California was set up in 1949. It conducted a famous study of writers, including Marianne Moore, William Carlos Williams, W.H. Auden, and Norman Mailer, all of whom they found, without exception, were more determined to succeed than the average and yet also more convinced of their own failure. That's the voice of the experts.
Historiometric and experimental data indicate several points of interest regarding writers.
Studies consistently find that from 50% to 80% of creative writers suffer from a mood disorder, as compared with less than 10% of the general population.
Writers also have a shorter lifespan than people in other occupations, including other artistic-related occupations.
Poets and fiction writers have higher suicide rates in comparison even to other writers.
Well,
I'm a writer. But I'm fine, thank you. Honestly, absolutely fine. Though my wiring is maybe a little loose.
All books are born somewhere in the region of unhappiness. Something is not right. Something has gone wrong. Someone is unhappy. Some good thing has gone.
It's true. Writing is often a form of, shall we say, malfunction. Take Richard Brautigan. Brautigan was committed to the Oregon State Hospital in Salem, the same hospital used for filming Ken Casey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. While in hospital, he was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and received electric shock therapy treatments. As did, though not in the same place and at the same time, Sylvia Plath, Ernest Hemingway, Antonin Artaud, Rocky Erickson, Robert M. Person, Lou Reed, David Foster Wallace, and Tammy Wynette. Some of the great artists of our age.
Yes, lightning strike patients will behave as though they have had electroconvulsive therapy, becoming confused and suffering amnesia.
Farmers used to be the primary victims of lightning, but recreation-related and professional injuries are now the more frequent.
It sounds pretty dangerous, and yet...
Yes?
Well...
Yes?
Perhaps.
Yes?
Let me put it this way. Better to be struck by lightning than to be left simply to rot away. There is a story by the great Eugene McCabe called Music at Annahullion, in which a woman and her brother find an old piano and bring it home, and they try to squeeze it into the parlour. But the piano's too big and they have to leave it outside to rot. That morning, writes McCabe, she covered the piano with plastic fertiliser bags. The guinea hens roosted on it all winter. Near dark one evening in February, she saw a sick rat squeeze in where the pedal had broken off. By April, varnish was peeling off the side. This, it seems to me, is a useful parable of the life of the writer. A piano left out in the rain.
He fumbles at your spirit as players at the keys. Before they dump full music on, he stuns you by degrees. Prepares your brittle substance for the ethereal blow. By fainter hammers, further heard, then nearer, then so slow. Your breath has time to straighten, your brain to bubble cool, deals one imperial thunderbolt that scalps your naked soul.
Fewer than a dozen of Emily Dickinson's poems were published during her lifetime. The hundreds of others were discovered after her death in a drawer and sent out to be published despite her explicit instruction that they be burned. Dickinson wrote her poems in pen and ink, and they were typed up by her estate. Personally, I prefer a pencil. I like pencils because you can rub the words out. You can dispose of the evidence. A pencil mark suggests that this is not perhaps one's last word on the subject. And so I've left behind me a long trail of pencil sharpenings, all the way from Essex, across the Irish Sea, and back again to England. My spore, my seed. The more I write, the less I become. The less I am, the better. And the quieter it becomes inside to hear the sound of the weather. Hath the rain a father? The Lord God sendeth rain. I can hear a distant thunder gathering over the plain.
The night is coming when no man may work. The night is coming soon.
How does it feel to finish, Mr. London?
Bring me the next book.
Bring me the next 1,000 books.
And put them to the back of the drawer.
How does it feel coming down, returning to normal?
Unbelievably strange.
An interviewer said to David Bowie, "For all the stories of your wildness, you seem very grounded."
Replied Bowie, in the voice of Michael Caine,
"You mean the electricity's all gone out of me."
Where does the electricity go?
Watch the sky for lightning.
Count the number of seconds until you hear thunder.
Every 5 seconds equals 1 mile.
Unlike the musician, or the actor, or the athlete, the writer never gets to experience the audience's reaction firsthand.
Because to clap, you need empty hands.
And a reader's hands are always filled with books.
So there is a distance, sometimes far too great a distance, between the crack of the inspirational lightning and the clap of the thunder, whatever that is. Let's call it the sound of recognition. And so the writer always finds themselves on their own again, somewhere in the dark, with an umbrella in the storm, looking out for the next electric cloud. It is a lucky writer that is struck by lightning, but a luckier one still that gets to hear a nearby clap of thunder.
A Postillion Struck by Lightning was written and performed by Ian Sansom and the Wireless Mystery Theatre. It was produced in Belfast by Claire Burgoyne. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley. We're live at the BBC Proms here on Radio 3, home of the Proms, where every note is broadcast live as it's being played. Well, this evening the BBC Philharmonic are giving the last of their 4 proms this season, conducted by their principal guest conductor, Jon Storgårds. The one work on the programme in this second half is a piece that's only gradually been accepted into the repertoire since its premiere in 1954, Korngold's Symphony in F-sharp. He was born in Brno in 1897, son of a music critic, was quite an extraordinary child prodigy as a composer, impressing Mahler when he was only 9 years old. In the mid-1930s, as his career was being blighted by the deteriorating political situation, Max Reinhardt invited him to Hollywood to compose the score for his film of A Midsummer Night's Dream. It was the first of a whole series of very symphonically conceived film scores which occupied Korngold in America for the next decade. After the Second World War, he returned to Europe and to composing for the concert hall. But Vienna in the 50s was not the place to write music in a basically late romantic idiom and have it accepted. Originally inspired by the death of President Roosevelt and dedicated to his memory, the symphony took Korngold some 5 years to complete. Tonight's conductor, Jon Sturgaage, is a real champion of this piece, and I asked him why it appealed to him so much.
Well, first of all, he's one of the most talented composers ever, I think. He was a child prodigy, first of all, and a really rare one. It's unbelievable what he could do already as a kid. He didn't lose anything of that skill and that energy and that fantastic touch in whatever he did after that. So I think it's really worth discovering. The real big heart of the piece is definitely the Adagio movement, which is a little bit a kind of a funeral march. Everything around that movement is sparkling, and it's so full of sudden changes in expression. It's really exciting and so skillfully done.
Jon Sturgaage, and here he comes, returning to the Royal Albert Hall platform to conduct the BBC Philharmonic in the first performance at the Proms of Korngold's Symphony.
Thank you.
I'm just watching Peter Dixon, principal cello of the BBC Philharmonic, virtually horizontal in his seat at the end of that. What a big play it is. A lot of rehearsal took place a week ago. They've brought it together. And stunning performance. Jon Storgårds conducting the BBC Philharmonic in the premier performance at the Proms of Korngold's Symphony. BBC Philharmonic led by Yuri Torchinsky. And the Proms premiere of a symphony by the man who still holds the record for being the youngest composer to have his work performed at the Proms. He was 15 in 1912 when Henry Wood gave the UK premiere of his ballet The Snowman, which he'd written when he was 11. And it's the slow movement, that wonderful slow movement that has a theme from Korngold's score for the 1939 Errol Flynn, Bette Davis romance, The Private Lives of Elizabeth and Essex. But when people suggested to Korngold that movement had to be a funeral march as a tribute to Roosevelt, to whom the score was dedicated, Korngold was insistent the symphony was pure, absolute music with no programme whatsoever. Jon Storgårds back on the platform, bringing the principal flutes, Richard Davis, and principal clarinet, John Bradbury, to their feet. These flute solos almost sounded like Aaron Copland. Well, they're almost through their season, the BBC Philharmonic. They're back up to Manchester and they're recording in Salford on Thursday, the Prokofiev second piano concerto that they played last night at the Proms with Jean-André Noseda and Jean-Yves Lambavoisier. Then they're off on a much-deserved holiday before the new season starts, but a weary-looking Jon Storgårds has got to summon some energy from somewhere. He's off to Finland, to Lapland, in fact, with his Lapland Chamber Orchestra tomorrow. The Grafenegg in Austria, and then back to the BBC Philharmonic at the start of the new season. Music by Sibelius, Nielsen, Kabalevsky, and Delius. Don't forget, if you've missed some of the music tonight, you can always hear it via the BBC Radio 3 website on the iPlayer. Indeed, if you enjoyed Vilde Frang's performance, proper Proms debut of the Bruch Concerto, you can hear that. You can also hear her playing her Proms matinee at the Cadogan Hall and see her indeed. All the Proms matinees this year have been filmed. Mozart, Lutosławski and Ravel back on the platform. Jon Storgårds bringing the entire woodwind section. Well, there'll be another intriguing programme tomorrow night here at the Royal Albert Hall. The music of Witold Lutosławski in this 100th anniversary of his birth, set against that of Gustav Holst. His Symphonic Variations Piano Concerto with Louis Lorty and Holst's Egdon Heath and his visionary masterpiece, The Planets. Not surprised we got Paul Turner, the principal timpanist of the BBC Philharmonic, to his feet. Wonderful work, and a lot of it this evening. Edward Gardner will be conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra. It all gets underway live, of course, here on Radio 3 at 7:30. But for now, with the hall still delighting in the rich sound world of Erich Wolfgang Korngold, time for me to hand you on to Jonathan Swain, waiting to guide you through the rest of your Radio 3 evening. Jonathan.
Martin, thank you very much. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall in the rich sound world of Korngold, going down pretty well here in Studio 30C as well. And as Martin was saying, if you want to listen to that prom again, or you missed part of it, every prom's available to listen to online via the Radio 3 website anytime you like for 7 days from the broadcast.
This summer, dip in to the BBC Proms. 25 years on from his acclaimed recording, Nigel Kennedy returns to the Albert Hall with Vivaldi's Four Seasons, adding some unique improvisational twists of his own between the concertos. The BBC Proms, alive with music. Vivaldi, The Four Seasons, Thursday night at 10:15, live on BBC Radio 3.
Back to this evening, and in around 12 minutes' time, our feature here on Radio 3, Renouncing India. Jatinder Verma reports from India on how asceticism still matters in a modernising state. That's at 10 o'clock. And followed on at 10:45 by the next in our current series of the essay, How Pleasant to Know Mr. Lear. Tonight, poet and academic Robert Crawford explores Edward Lear's literary legacy. As for the here and now, well, with two of Gustav Holst's orchestral masterworks, Egdon Heath and The Planets, in tomorrow night's prom, this is one of Holst's finest works for unaccompanied chorus, The Evening Watch. It's an eight-part motet for mixed choir with two soloists, and it sets a questioning dialogue by the 17th-century English metaphysical poet Henry Vaughan between the body and the soul parting at the moment of death. Holst asks for a serene, sustained pianissimo until the last bars, when the choral sound expands into a blaze of fervour to illuminate the closing words. Yet this take with thee, that last gasp of time is thy first breath and man's eternal prime. Paul Spicer directs the Finzi Singers.
Thank you.
Evening Watch, a poem by Henry Vaughan set to music in 1924 by Gustav Holst. Paul Spicer there directing the Finzi singers, and the soloists were alto Susanna Spicer and tenor Mark Milhofer. The Evening Watch had its first performance the following year, 1925, at the Three Choirs Festival in Gloucester Cathedral. Holst intended it to be the first of a pair of motets, the second being this one, Sing Me the Men. The words are by Digby Mackworth Dolben, who became a monk while still a schoolboy at Eton and died in a drowning accident at the tender age of 20.
Sing me the men. Thank you.
Sing We the Men, Opus 42, I beg your pardon, Opus 43, number 2, by Gustav Holst. Paul Spicer directing the Finzi Singers. And as I say, there are two Holst orchestral masterworks in tomorrow night's prom, Egdon Heath and The Planets. Complimentary in a way when you think about it. Thomas Hardy's Wessex as Earth, one of the planets missing from Holst's astrological suite. Edward Gardner conducts the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and they're joined by pianist Louis Lorty for Lutosławski's monumental 1988 piano concerto. That's tomorrow's prom, live from the Royal Albert Hall, here on BBC Radio 3, starting at 7:30. Well, looking ahead to Thursday.
After an absence of almost 20 years, piano soloist Mitsuko Uchida returns to the BBC Proms, playing Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 4 in the first of two BBC Proms concerts given by the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra and its chief conductor Maris Janssens. A pair of concerts culminating with Mahler's Second Symphony, The Resurrection, on Friday. Join me, Christopher Cook, for the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra at the Proms on BBC Radio 3, Thursday night from 7 o'clock.
Back to this Tuesday evening, it's just gone 10 o'clock. And now we begin a second chance to hear two features with Jatinder Verma reporting from India. Photographs of saffron-clad ascetics on the pilgrim routes of India are familiar to us, but who are these people and why do they choose to renounce materialism and ignore the conventional world around them? Jatinder Verma examines the future and function of the renouncer in modern India and asks whether they can survive the economic boom that's transforming the nation.
Holy water flows as effortlessly as plain water, but only those with knowledge can taste it. The lyrics of India's most famous medieval female poet, Mirabai, sung in the heart of the Indian capital. Delhi is one of the fastest growing cities on earth, with a population of over 22 million and counting. India is in a frenzy of transformation. As the country modernizes and its 300 million strong middle class enjoy the high-end fashion malls, the Japanese cars, and the new gleaming high-rise suburbs, a devotional song sung before a group of sannyasins might appear incongruous. Sannyasins are individuals who choose to renounce the world. They are the wandering sadhus, usually dressed in saffron and carrying nothing but a begging bowl and staff. Nobody really knows, but there may be as many as 17 million such people roaming the roads of modern India. I'm here to find out why these men and women renounce the families they were born into. What form does their renunciation take? And what influence renunciation has on pressing modern issues such as political corruption, the environment, and feminism?
I would say it is the cultural ideal, and it has been there from time immemorial, somewhere around 600 BC. So I would say the renunciant tradition has impacted people across the spectrum. Rich, poor, male, female, old, young, everybody.
They are said to be the roaming gods on the earth. And of course, Indian society as it is, it does revere the sannyasins.
The whole structure, the warp and the weft of Indian society is kind of shot through and through with ideas of renunciation. In a sense, every Hindu is a renouncer in potentio, because when they reach a certain age, they're supposed to renounce the world.
The idea of renunciation has been institutionalized in India like nowhere else on the planet. Early in India's long history, renunciation became so prevalent, energized by the new faiths of Buddhism and Jainism, that it caused orthodox authorities to weigh in. Around 300 BC, the laws of Manu were compiled to incorporate the revolutionary idea of renunciation into a more orderly structure of life. These laws are less a set of injunctions and more of a sociological text mapping the nature of Indian society. To counter the effects of Buddhism and Jainism, Orthodox Hindu mandarins
developed an ideal life plan that divided life into four equal 25-year ashrams, or periods of education, productivity, charitable service, and renunciation. Delhi historian Nilima Chitgopikar and Varanasi temple headman Professor Mishra describe these stages of life that Manu urged Hindus to follow.
In the first ashram, which is when you're a student, you have to be celibate and you have to study. You go preferably to your guru and you study. That will go on till the age varies till about 20 or 25. And it's, mind you, just for males. And then in the second one, you become a householder. You get married and you are a grahasth. So the second ashram is the grahasth ashram. You stay married. You lead a very nice sensual sexual life. And in fact, you're encouraged to, you know, be very, very active and, you know, be there theater and music and get involved in all the sensual things, etc. And procreate and have children, etc. Very clearly said, this is the age for that.
Then between 50 and 75, one should think, my innings are over and I should become the drashta. I should look at the game which is played in this world. And after 75 years, you should leave everything.
Even in the earlier sensual or productive stage of life, the long-term ideals of renunciation should be kept in sight, according to the sannyasin Swami Varishtananda.
Selfishness will never give you peace, even in family life. If a husband or a wife is selfish, gone, the family falls apart. Children, if they become selfish, family goes. That family life is gradual education into unselfishness. And there comes a time where not only unselfishness, selflessness, which you see in these great saints.
It's an extraordinary idea that family life is, the purpose of it is to lead to gradual unselfishness.
Absolutely. That's the whole purpose. See, family life is no joke. It's not, in fact, family life, if you want to lead it properly, it takes a lot of doing. See, you have to earn money in a good way, and then you have to spend it well. You have to look after your family. At the same time, you have to become unselfish so that you can serve society at large.
The stages of life have become part of the DNA of Indian culture, with literature, painting, sculpture, and music serving to popularize them. The great epic of the Mahabharata, for example, provides us with an archetypical sannyasin, Bhishma. Known in popular culture as Grandfather Bhishma, his decision to renounce his royal birthright spawned the cataclysmic civil war that is at the heart of the epic. I met up with two modern-day sannyasins with different experiences. 80-year-old K.V. Subramanian lives in a religious retreat founded by one of India's great saints, Ramana Maharishi, in Tamil Nadu, where K.V. has lived for the past 40 years. But first, Swami Sanand in the great city on the Ganges, Varanasi.
When I took sannyas last year, I had completed 79 years, so I think I was already 4 years late. According to the normal system, I should have taken sannyas when I was 75 years.
There is a saying, a sannyasi who has a penny is not worth a penny. A householder who doesn't have a penny is not worth a penny. A sannyasi is supposed to be one who has renounced the world and its possessions and dedicates his whole time in quest of truth and the self. Self is truth. As a Gandhian who was already getting fascinated by a life of no possession, and they found with very little you can manage very well, and if 1,000 things can be bought, 1,000,000 things are free, and they saw very few money people enjoy the things which are free. But without money you have time.
I do feel that after taking sannyas and this new name, I have been rid of a number of bondages that were in different ways trying to keep me down from what I would freely decide to do.
Bondages like?
Bondages like relatives, my brothers, my nephews, the whole family, my former students, my former friends, all those people. Now I am not that person. I can very clearly refuse to accept any past relationships.
The majority find the idea of leaving home and family, stripping away clothes and taking a new name and new life, inconceivable. sitting in his ancient temple home overlooking the Ganges on Tulsi Ghat, where the final four chapters of the Ramayana were written in the 17th century, Professor Mishra describes the customary practice of the sannyasins in Varanasi.
He is not supposed to touch even books, and he is not supposed to cook and touch the fire. There is no question of living in the family, and he should just be pursuing the Supreme Being, total renunciation. You should go to seven houses and ask for food. And whatever you get, then you bring it and submerge it in Ganga so that all the taste is gone, and then you eat that food. If you don't get foods on some day, the seven houses, you have got nothing, then you should be hungry.
The idea of not even touching books seems extraordinary. Indeed, one of the symbolic acts of becoming a sannyasin is to burn the religious text. Most modern sadhus don't go to such extremes, but India abounds with stories of sannyasins who have to undergo the most bizarre forms of penance, sitting for years with their arms in the air, men who pierce themselves or grow their nails into horrific tangles, or who can drag trunks of wood by their genitals. The god Shiva provides the inspiration for most sannyasins. He remains the most ascetic of gods and one who best sums up this uniquely Indian oppositional interaction between the emerging middle classes and the renouncer tradition, as Nilima Chitgopekar explains.
Within Shiva's personhood, you have both the things, the ascetic ideal and the householder ideal. And I would say that that's what all many people in India try to maintain the two together. Shiva is the first yogi. So Shiva was the Mahayogi, but over a period of time when he needed more acceptance with the people, we find in the scriptures, by and by, they are bringing him into the household fold. So over a period of time, we find him assimilating different ideas, ideas of marriage, ideas of fatherhood. But they can't do away with the original Shiva, who was a yogi, who was an ascetic, who was a sannyasi, who had given up everything. So they maintain the two, and they say there is a constant, there's a constant fight, there's a constant conflict between these two ideals. The householder ideal, which is Shiva with his wife Parvati and the two children, Ganesha and Skanda. And then there's the ascetic who goes into the forest or goes into the Himalayas and spends lots of time by himself.
And Shiva has been the main inspiration for the fiercest-looking sect of sannyasins in India, the Naga Sadhus, who emulate their hero by wearing their hair and beards matted and almost deliberately offend middle-class sensibilities.
We're walking through the narrow gullies, the small lanes of Banaras, in search of the Mahanirvani Akhada. An Akhada is a training school. And this particular akhara is run by the Naga sannyasis. The Naga sadhus can best be described as India's religious army. And we've just arrived at the banks of the Ganges, and in front of us is this giant door guarding the entrance to the temple complex where the Naga sannyasis are. And we hope to meet Sri Mohant Rabindragiri, one of the secretaries of this akhara.
हमारा नाम महंत रविंद्र गिरी श्री पंचायती अखाड़ा महानिर्वाणी शिवाला घाट पर आता हूं
श्री महंत जी हैज डिस्क्राइब्ड टू मी द वे इन व्हिच दिस अखाड़ा फंक्शंस फॉर अ स्टार्ट दे ओनली टेक इन सेलिबेट्स दे ओनली टेक इन बॉयज हु आर ओवर 18 एंड बॉयज हु हैव नो टाइज विद देयर फैमिलीज सो दोस आर द थ्री कंडीशंस इन दिस कॉम्प्लेक्स दे हैव टू लिव दे आर क्लोथ्ड दे आर फेड एंड दे अंडरटेक ट्रेनिंग बोथ इन texts as well as weapons training. And the particular weapons that they train in are the spear and the sword. Scattered around India, there are around 70,000 Naga sannyasins, the Dharmic Sena, the Dharmic army. In other words, the defense force of the religion.
Om Namah Shivaya. Har Har Mahadev. Har Har Mahadev.
Well, the Naga sadhus say that they are Shiva, to, you know, have that kind of, those kind of dreadlocks, to be living in crematoriums, because that's what they do, to sit and take the ash from the dead bodies and rub it on there, you know, because that's all Shiva-like. That's what Shiva used to do. And this is all his renunciation of, you know, what is considered pure, what is considered impure. Nothing is pure, nothing is impure. Shiva is fond of everything. So the Naga sadhus are taking up the aspects that suit them the most. You know, smoking pot, nudity, a belligerence, an aggression, great aggression, that we will do what we want to do.
The Nagas have schools that function in a similar fashion to madrasas, inducting young men to their militant, anarchic and ubermensch philosophy. But many other sannyasins draw their inspiration for political direct action from a more obvious modern example, choosing to follow in the footsteps of Mahatma Gandhi.
A busy main road surrounds the Ramlila grounds here on the outskirts of Old Delhi. This vast open space is where every autumn the great